exceptions in each occurrence. A theory made popular by Malcolm Gladwell in his book Outliers states that success in any field comes from 10,000 hours of deep practice. In this book, he looks at several masters of their field, the Beatles, Bill Gates, and Beethoven, and highlights the fact that they all achieved 10,000 hours of practice prior to breaking out. Framing success in this way helps people to realize that success doesn't happen overnight, but it's also a results-oriented way of viewing the process. Success, mastery, and learning are all achieved from a large number of hours practicing, but the quality of those hours matter. What you practice, how you practice, and the effort you put into that practice are just as important, if not more important, as the quantifiable amount of time you practice. It is important to draw a distinction between the 10,000-hour theory of success, which relates to mastery of an entire discipline, and the success achieved in the development of individual skills. It won't take you 10,000 hours to fix a tilt problem, just like it didn't take you 10,000 hours to learn how to do an EV calculation or drive a car. When working on individual skills within a discipline, it is more accurate to think in terms of number of quality repetitions and not just total time. Imagine that it takes 1,000 repetitions to master a skill, such as knowing when to value bet on the river. Playing within your normal game, i.e., level 3 in the transfer of skill model, each time you correctly value bet on the river equals 1 repetition. So based on this hypothetical estimate, you need 1,000 reps to master that skill. More difficult situations have a multiplying effect on the value of repetitions. Proper execution in a level 4 situation is valued at 2 reps, which means you could master it in 500 repetitions instead of 1,000. Then let's say that you find yourself in a level 5 situation. For example, playing in a tough high-stakes game full of professional poker players, including a few who intimidate you. River value betting situations in this scenario might be worth 4 reps, meaning you could potentially master it in a quarter of the time. At the other end of the scale are repetitions that have less value. For example, studying, warming up, cooling down, or talking over hands with a friend might each be worth a quarter of a repetition. This is because, comparatively, they are taking place in low-stress situations. Although these repetitions aren't worth as much, they're still valuable and at no cost to your bankroll. Get into the habit of doing them regularly because they accumulate rapidly and facilitate gaining the more valuable reps you need at the table. Keep in mind that how you study can have this multiplying effect as well. Active study, such as taking notes and asking a coach questions, can be worth more than just passively watching a video or reading an article. You also need to make sure that what you are repeating is what you actually want to learn. Otherwise, you're just training bad habits. Repeating a negative habit, example, playing weak hands from the small blind or skipping a warm-up, costs you twice. Not only did you lose an opportunity to reinforce the correct play, you repeated the bad one. In other words, you got better at the mistake, not the correction. Now it'll take you 2 repetitions to get back to where you could have been had you made the correct play in the first place. Hopefully you are beginning to realize that playing only in soft games is not always the best approach. Putting yourself in situations where you might struggle is a fantastic way to accelerate learning. This is not to say that you should jump into the toughest games you can find. You could go broke before ever coming close to being world class. On the other hand, taking shots in tougher games or higher stakes, pushing yourself even when you don't want to, playing through when you are tired or tilting, and trying to learn concepts you have a hard time understanding will all have a profoundly greater impact on your learning than just showing up and playing your standard game. Many players don't realize how effective and helpful playing can be in their learning process. Playing poker is like taking a test, and educational research has recently shown that retention for knowledge is stronger and lasts longer when students are given tests rather than just studying. The act of taking a test, or playing poker, forces you to dig information out of your memory and communicate it in a coherent way. It's one thing to take information in, but it's the quality of the output of that information at the poker table that enables you to be successful. Barry's take. Deliberate practice. Deliberate practice refers to a form of training that consists of grueling, repetitive practice whereby performers constantly respond to feedback and correct errors. Over the last decade, a growing body of research is emerging that debunks the idea that natural talent alone is what produces elite performers. Psychologist K. Anders Ericsson from Florida State University is the pioneer behind this research, which concludes that expert performers in all fields share the same traits in how they approach practice. Almost everyone we consider to be naturally talented, such as Tiger Woods in golf and Jerry Seinfeld in comedy, are actually just the hardest working. One common trait found among expert performers is not just the fact that they practice so much, it's that they constantly practice doing something that tests the limits of their ability. They strive to reach higher than their current ability, very often fail, and then try again. Michael Jordan is one of the most recognizable examples of this dedication to challenging oneself, as he is noted for a devotion to turning his weaknesses into his greatest strengths. Why are Brazilians so good at soccer? One of the reasons is because as children, they play a game called futsal, which uses a smaller, heavier ball in a smaller playing area. When they finally get to a normal soccer field, they make the game look easy, but it's really a product of intensive training in a tougher environment. Another attribute of deliberate practice is breaking down the specific skills required to be successful in your craft and focusing on improving those chunks of skill. In his autobiography titled Open, Andre Agassi describes regular practice with a ball machine he dubbed the Monster. Andre's father had rigged the machine so it would send balls flying at him at speeds much faster than normal. So fast, in fact, that it helped him to become one of the best tennis players in the world and one of the best at returning serves. Thousands of hours battling the Monster honed his reaction so deeply that serves in excess of 130 miles per hour posed little challenge. How does deliberate practice apply to poker? Well, the most important thing is to be aware that this concept exists. Most people look at Phil Ivey and assume he's just a natural talent, but not everybody knows that he played poker illegally for years as a teenager with a fake ID. So before the rest of his peers ever set foot in a casino, he had already acquired years of experience. While Ivey doesn't speak often about his game, he shared this in an interview during the 2012 WSOP. "There are tons of mistakes every session, even for me. What separates me from a lot of the other players is that I recognize the mistakes when I make them. I just practice. I think about the game all the time, and I'm continually trying to get better." The next thing to consider is the idea of challenging yourself. Even though the conventional wisdom says to look for softer games, players like Phil Galfond seek out tough games to become more formidable. Deliberate practice is all about flexing muscles you didn't know you had, failing, and getting better. Practice is not supposed to be fun. If it were, everyone would do it. If you want some additional reading on deliberate practice, check out these three excellent books: Talent is Overrated by Jeff Colvin, The Talent Code by Daniel Coyle, and Bounce by Matthew Said. Feedback. Feedback is the information about your performance that you gain from sources such as people, data, and results. The accuracy of the information you receive in your feedback is paramount because it determines the adjustments needed to keep you moving towards your goals. There is no superior form of feedback that alone can help you maneuver through the immense amount of uncertainty inevitable in poker. The best you can do is to gather several forms of feedback to generate the most complete and accurate portrait as possible. While there are many potential forms of feedback, poker players tend to overuse the one that is least reliable in the short run: results. It is simply lazy to use results as the primary method of determining your edge and evaluating your progress. Results are handed to you in poker. No work is required to gather this data. You just have to look at your stack size, cashier, or bankroll. The problem is that focusing solely on results can create chaos in your game, mental game, and learning process. If you believed everything your results said, 10-6 offsuit might be a monster, and pocket kings a terrible hand. Plus, your confidence would now be based on whether you won or lost, not on how you played. That being said, ignoring results altogether is equally problematic. If you tend to ignore results, it is even more important to use other forms of feedback, otherwise you will have no way of navigating the inevitable uncertainty of the short term. Other valuable forms of feedback include your opinions, how well you played, the severity of variance you experienced, and the quality of the games. Emotions. Emotions such as anger, fear, or loss of motivation provide feedback on your mental game. Math. Pot odds, equity calculations, EV calculations, and ICM calculations. Statistics. Hold'em manager stats, EV graphs, and time elapsed. Others' opinions, thoughts from a coach, friend, or other player at the table. Instruction. Coaching, books, articles, training videos, and hand history reviews. All forms of feedback have biases, Even statistics can be misleading. For example, all-in EV is often relied upon as a measure of how a player is running, when in fact it measures just a slice of overall variance. Opinions, emotions, and instruction are all biased in some way too. Players are often biased when evaluating their performance because of their strong desire to believe they played well. Plus, it's easy to convince yourself that you played well when results are good. Emotions are the purest form of feedback, but so few players know how to read them properly, and so they are often misinterpreted. A coach may think you should adapt your style to fit their own, or might see mistakes in your game that are really only leaks at their stakes, not yours. A friend might be too sympathetic to be objective. You can minimize the chances that these biases will have negative impacts on your game by considering the pertinent information from multiple forms of feedback. When measured against and next to each other, they can even function to highlight a particularly glaring bias that you would have otherwise accepted as accurate and credible information. This will give you the clearest possible picture of your progress and the current state of your tactical skill and mental game. Incorporating additional forms of feedback into your learning routine can be challenging and overwhelming at first. Nonetheless, it is worth putting in the work. Which scenario sounds more accurate and convincing? 1. You know you are beating 1-2 because you have been winning at 5 BBs per 100 for the last 40,000 hands. 2. You know you are beating 1-2 because you have a solid win rate, your coach thinks you are doing well, you're fixing the C-game mistakes you have been working on, you better understand the instruction from training videos, and feel confident in your play, and tilt hasn't been an issue. You probably feel more convinced by the second scenario, since it describes your progress with so much more depth. The first scenario seems quite one-dimensional and flat by comparison. For it to be reliable, you'd need such a large sample of results that by the time you had enough, you'd have missed out on a lot of opportunities to improve. Ultimately, you have to become skilled at distinguishing the valuable information from all the rest. Additional feedback. This may sound obvious, but when you speak, you hear what you say, and when you write, you also see what's been written. When learning, it is always beneficial to stimulate as many senses as possible to allow your brain to understand the information on multiple levels. Just thinking about something often doesn't allow you to connect with the material in a dynamic and long-lasting way. Ever think you've come up with an interesting way to play a hand, only to say it out loud or write it down and realize how dumb it is? When studying, try to utilize other tools besides just thinking, regardless of whether it's a video, book, article, or forum post. By writing, talking, hearing, and/or seeing, you automatically increase your interaction with the material. Of course, that doesn't mean you have to write down everything in your head. Beyond being impractical, it's just simply not necessary. Just keep in mind how thinking can be isolating and how valuable it can be to employ a variety of methods in your learning process. Rest. The connection between rest and learning is not as widely understood as the connection between rest and performance. When you study and play poker, you absorb information like a sponge. When you rest, it's as if that information is squeezed out. Try and remember an instance where you kept thinking about hands long after you finished playing, perhaps at a time when you were trying to sleep. The brain is digesting that information and uses it to grow new neurons, make stronger connections between existing ones, and eliminate old ones. This not only helps your poker skills to become more solid, it also clears your mind and makes absorbing new information easier the next time you play. The importance of getting rest is similar for both the body and mind. Getting intensive mental repetitions while working on tilt control, bet sizing, or pre-flop calling ranges is similar to working out with weights in the gym. While lifting weights, you tear muscle fibers. This is normal and happens as you push your muscles beyond their current capabilities. Resting allows the body to repair these tears so your muscles can grow stronger. Without it, these tears cannot heal, and so instead, your muscles become weaker. The same is true as you learn to lift more mental weight playing poker. When you get proper rest, your knowledge base becomes stronger, so your decisions are clearer, quicker, and easier. Mental game issues become less of a problem because you've returned with more strength and can remain in control at times you previously couldn't. When your mind is overworked and unable to recover, it won't be able to handle those issues and will crumble under their weight. Many poker players, especially high-volume grinders and those who live close to a casino, have a hard time taking breaks away from the game. Players who find themselves playing all the time don't realize the unintended consequences that this has on their ability to improve over the long term. Their short-sighted attempt to make as much money as possible as quickly as possible can ultimately lead to a decline in their long-term profitability. They rely on the momentum of playing to help them maintain high-level play. As a result, when they come back from even a short break, their game has slipped so far that it's difficult to recover. The reason this happens is that their minds can only absorb so much data that they are accumulating during their nonstop play. So the information that hasn't had the time to truly be learned ends up dissolving and can no longer be accessed. This means that each time they come back from a break, they have to recapture that data all over again in order to start rebuilding their game. Rest replenishes the energy you need to perform at a high level and enables you to return to the game in a better place, both mentally and physically. Fantasy of the fresh start. Some players view rest not as a way to improve their skills over the long term, but as a way to wipe out a downswing, tilt, or a streak of bad play. The time off is a good way to clear their minds and come back fresh, ready to play at a high level. While that can work, some players take this idea to extreme levels. They delete a losing Hold'em Manager database, ignore previous mistakes, or wake up and say to themselves, "Today is a new day," and automatically think that something is different. They believe that their past is holding them back, and that these actions somehow give them the power to escape it. Unfortunately, they'll be repeating the past until they're able to learn from it. You don't want to wipe away poor results and mistakes, because learning what not to do is valuable. When you make mistakes, you're basically paying for your education. The important question isn't whether you pay to learn. It's, are you repeatedly paying for the same information? If learning is like completing a complicated maze, why would you want to forget all of the wrong turns you took? Mistakes help you to learn what is right, and so starting fresh really only means that you have to pay for all those valuable lessons again. Using rest as a way to get a fresh start is reasonable only if you also directly address the real problems in your tactical and mental game. Otherwise, they will force you to keep taking time off from playing. Rest is best used as a tool to help you learn and develop a stronger game, not as a way to wipe out your past without learning anything from it. Learning to learn. Learning is incredibly complex, and knowing how to best approach it can be difficult. It's quite common for poker players to feel overwhelmed with the sheer amount of material and formats available today. Great attention has been given to keeping the information in this section simple, yet potent. By the end, you'll be armed with an advanced method of learning poker. Whether you're a new player or a nosebleed regular, these are the four steps that are key to learning to learn. Define how you learn. Improve your C game. Solve your learning errors. Make continual progress. Define how you learn. Efficiency is doing things right. Effectiveness is doing the right things. Peter Drucker, educator and management consultant. There are players with an innate talent for learning poker, just as there are players with an innate talent for playing it. Learning and playing are skills that typically aren't thought of separately, because better players are assumed to be better at learning. While this is generally true, many talented players lack essential learning skills. This allows other less talented players, who are better learners, to gain an edge. These two skills together are a powerful combination. To become more skilled at learning, you first need to understand the range that exists in your current skills. Players don't regularly assess their ability to learn, but it's just as important as assessing tactical and mental game skills. Just as you did when analyzing your A to C game range, start with the biggest areas of strength and weakness, and then fill in everything in between. The following questions will help get you thinking. What does your approach to learning look like when you're highly motivated to work on your game? What does your approach to learning look like when you're at your very worst? What are your biggest learning strengths and weaknesses? Do you benefit from talking with other players about hands? How often does a mistake distract you while playing? Does a mistake ever get stuck in your mind long after you're done playing? Do you avoid working on your game off the table and instead learn mainly by playing? While watching a video or reading a book, do you have specific areas of your game in mind? Are you actively trying to understand the material and looking for information that can benefit your game? Are you a visual learner, or do you learn better by experiencing or hearing something? Do you learn better by working on your game independently or by talking with other players? If you study or talk over hands with other players, why is it valuable to you? What does it provide that you can't get by working alone? Thinking back to when you were in school, what were the most enjoyable and effective ways that you studied or learned? What bad habits did you develop in school that are still a problem today? A simple way to improving your learning is to do more of what already works for you and less of what doesn't. That may sound obvious and overly simplistic, But have you ever taken a step back to ask if what you're doing to learn or develop skills is actually working? It is standard for poker players to question their decisions at the poker table, but it is far less common, yet equally important, for them to question their approach to learning. Barry's take: fixed and growth mindsets. Some of the most groundbreaking research on learning in the last 20 years comes not from how you learn, but your attitudes towards it. Carol Dweck, PhD, the author of Mindset, The New Psychology of Success, has spent most of her career studying achievement and success, and she found two distinct ways in which people think about their own ability. She calls them the fixed mindset and the growth mindset. The fixed mindset believes ability is static, predetermined, and unlikely to improve beyond current capability. The growth mindset believes that talents and abilities can be developed through training and hard work. People with a fixed mindset tend to be biased towards seeking out information that confirms the view they have of their ability. One of the classic examples of a fixed mindset in Dweck's book is John McEnroe, winner of 7 Grand Slam titles in tennis. She observed that his insistence on arguing with umpires is a textbook example of a fixed mindset. He argued in order to preserve his image of greatness, rather than recognize errors that he could have learned from. Although McEnroe was a tennis legend, Dweck highlights a number of areas where his fixed mindset potentially held him back from further greatness. For example, not playing mixed doubles for 20 years after being beaten in straight sets. People with a growth mindset are much more receptive to hearing new things that challenge their beliefs. Dweck draws on a huge range of examples from the world of sports, business, entertainment, parenting, and education, and illustrates how the top achievers in almost all fields exhibited traits of the growth mindset. From Thomas Edison and Tiger Woods to Winston Churchill and Michael Jordan, they all embrace their failures and constantly strive to grow. As a poker journalist, I have interviewed most of the big names in the game. The one thing I've noticed above all else is that the consistently successful ones are still actively working hard on their game and love to discuss hands like most of us did when we first started playing. They have reached the highest levels of the game, and their commitment to learning and growth is what got them there and what keeps them there. The variance in poker makes it perhaps easier to maintain a fixed mindset than in most fields. You can dismiss your losses as bad luck where you did nothing wrong, instead of looking for areas where you can make improvement. Players with a fixed mindset don't have to remain fixed. Just look at Phil Hellmuth, whose nickname the Poker Brat came directly from his similarities with John McEnroe. In recent years, he has recommitted himself to improving his game, and that has translated into both success and respect at the tables. Improve your C game. To build a taller pyramid, you need a wider base. For your game to grow stronger, you need a bigger and stronger foundation to build it on. Your C game is the cracks in that foundation. Even if you take nothing else from this section, carefully consider the following advice, as it can have a very valuable impact on your ability to learn. If you are unsure of what to work on in your game, your C game will be the most beneficial and rewarding place to start. It's also the simplest. Learning can be overwhelming, daunting, and complex at times. Knowing you can always focus on the 3 or 4 worst things in your game gives you a reliable and easy starting point. If you maintain an up-to-date A to C game analysis, you will always know what to work on. That saves you time and energy and prepares you to improve your C game every time you play. Looking at the mental side of your tactical leaks is very important. There is always some mental component to a C game tactical mistake, even if only a subtle one. For example, you might take too passive a line in a hand because of a risk aversion. Or, if you are overly aggressive on the river, it could be because deep down you think you can win every hand. The degree to which a mental game leak is involved directly corresponds to the severity of the tactical error. The more severe the tactical error, the more involved the mental game issue. Breaking through mental game problems makes it much easier to eliminate tactical mistakes. In order to fix a mental game problem, such as fear, tilt, or low confidence, you must first understand what's causing it. The mental hand history is a process that was developed to help players quickly get to the root of their mental game problems. Just as a weed grows back if not pulled out by the roots, so too will a mental game problem if the underlying cause isn't corrected. How well a player can complete the mental hand history is dependent on their knowledge of the issue and the mental game in general. Going through the process for the same issue several times allows new details to emerge. They can then dig deeper to find new insights that further strengthen the correction and reduce the intensity of the emotion around the problem. If you struggle to complete the process, Look to resources including TMGP to help you. The Mental Hand History has 5 steps and works best when your answers are written out rather than done in your head. The steps are as follows. 1. Describe the problem in as much detail as you can, including thoughts, feelings, actions, and associated tactical decisions. 2. Explain why it makes logical sense to think, feel, react, or play that way. In other words, why does this problem occur? All mental game problems are rational, so if you think yours doesn't make sense, it's only because you don't yet have enough information to complete this step. This step is the hardest, so don't be discouraged if it takes you several days or weeks to complete it. 3. Figure out how the logic in step 2 is flawed. 4. Come up with a correction to that flawed logic. This correction can be used as an injecting logic statement. You can also write out a strategy that you can use to learn the correction. 5. Ask yourself why the correction you came up with will work. This is an extra step that reinforces the rationale behind the correction and helps to firmly implant it in your mind. To illustrate these steps in action, here's an example that deals with tilt. 1. Describe the problem. I get angry when I lose to bad players and play too aggressively against them. I can never believe it's happening, and all I can think about is getting my money back. 2. Explain why it makes logical sense to think, feel, react, or play that way. I feel like I deserve to win more than they do, because I work so much harder in my game. I know it's not smart to play more aggressively, but I also know it's the quickest way to win my money back. 3. Figure out how the logic in step 2 is flawed. Several reasons. Without luck, bad players wouldn't even play, and poker would stop being profitable. It's also not really my money anymore. The money on the table is an investment in my edge. Some days that investment pays off, and others it doesn't. But if I play worse trying to get that money back, I'll make less money in the long run. Lastly, every time I make the same stupid mistakes, I actually get better at them and limit my ability to improve in the future. So not only am I losing money right now, I'm also increasing the probability that I'll lose money in the future. 4. Come up with a correction to that flawed logic. My hard work isn't destroyed when I lose to a bad player. It's destroyed when I make mistakes trying to win money too aggressively. I'm also destroying the future of my game and need to work hard to play solidly no matter how pissed off I get. 5. Ask yourself why the correction you came up with will work. It allows me to make the most money over the long term by consistently making the best decisions, period. Players sometimes have difficulty creating injecting logic statements that work, but the information from steps 3 and 4 cuts straight to the core of the issue. Here are a few options from the examples above. Without luck, bad players wouldn't even play, and poker would stop being profitable. The money on the table is an investment in my edge. Some days that investment pays off, and others it doesn't. Or, my hard work isn't destroyed when I lose to a bad player, it's destroyed when I make mistakes trying to win money too aggressively. The one you should select is simply the one that works best, and you may have to try out a few in order to determine that. Although the Mental Hand History was originally designed as a tool for breaking down and correcting mental game issues, it can easily be adapted to address tactical leaks as well. Here's an example of how to break down a tactical error using the Mental Hand History. 1. Describe the problem. I'm bluffing too much against a player who has a high calling percentage. 2. Explain the logic behind that. He can't have it all the time. He must be due to fold. 3. Figure out how the logic in step 2 is flawed. The only information I have so far is that he doesn't fold easily. Also, my image will be viewed as wild, and my range will be perceived as wide. Both make it more likely I will be called. 4. Come up with a correction to that flawed logic. I need to narrow my range and value bet more. 5. Ask yourself why the correction you came up with will work. With my image, I'll be called by this player at a high frequency, so I really need superior hands in order to win. Ideally, you want to take each tactical C-game mistake and its associated mental game leak through this process. The reason for this is that you will likely uncover similar theoretical errors among them. Let's say you have 8 specific tactical errors as part of your C-game. When you analyze each one, you'll often find that many have the same flaw. In other words, you might not find 8 flaws for the 8 errors. There could be lots of overlap. So, rather than having to remember 8 different corrections, you now only need to remember the few overlapping ones that apply to all 8 different spots. When these tactical leaks have a strong connection to a mental game issue, it makes more sense and is more efficient to solve both at the same time. Barry's take. How I fixed a leak. One particular leak of mine that developed over a couple years was being too passive with second pair type hands. I would get dealt pocket queens, the flop would come king high, and I would go right into my default line of either bluff catching or check folding. Even though it's often right to do this, there are also tons of times when betting for value or to take down the pot is the best option. Now is not the time to go into the merits of each line because it's very situationally dependent. It's clear, however, that I was shutting down way too much in this spot and it was hurting my game. Being passive with second pair hands was what was learned to the level of unconscious competence. It was my instinctual reaction. I usually play 8 or more tables and needed to find a way of making a quick decision about whether the conditions seemed right to continuation bet or check. So I set a goal to remind myself to be aware of this issue by writing it on a notepad at the start of my sessions. Then I marked every hand on Hold'em Manager where it came up. At the end of my sessions, I evaluated all the second pair hand situations to assess how I did. In my journal, I would answer questions such as, did I bet where I would previously have checked? What did my gut tell me to do? Was I right to do it in these situations? Then in my warm-up before future sessions, I reviewed my notes and looked over some of the hand histories as a reminder of my progress and recent mistakes. Away from the table, I studied my hand histories further by putting players on ranges, posting hands on forums, and generally assessing the merits of each option in each spot. Thankfully, Hold'em Manager has present filters to pick out these spots, so I could even look at hands from ages ago to see how I played them. I also watched training videos with the specific intent of seeing what the instructors did in second pair spots. For the most part, I ignored the rest of the information on display in the video to avoid getting overwhelmed. I wrote out their reasoning for betting out with second pair hands, as well as for the times they didn't. Probably the biggest leaps came when I discussed specific hands with poker friends. Not only did they challenge my viewpoint, just talking about my reasoning out loud made such a huge difference. All of this went in my journal, so I could easily review it later. 4 months and 80,000 hands after I first started, the correction was learned to the level of unconscious competence. It wasn't easy. There were a lot of instances where I felt like I had solved the problem, but would find myself insta-checking second pair hands in tough spots, such as in deep pots or live games. Ultimately, what helped more than any other correction I used in the past was varying the way I tacked the issue and constantly assessing where the correction was in the ALM. I even took an extended break from poker, and the correction was still there when I came back, even without thinking about it. After completing the process of defining and understanding your mental and tactical C-game, you can then start implementing the corrections with the goal of training them to the level of unconscious competence. Here are suggestions for creating a cycle of improvement that will help you to efficiently master corrections to your C-game. Warm-up. You must be prepared to make corrections to your C-game every time you play. It may take a few minutes to refresh your memory and to get focused on your C-game mistakes and their corrections, but it's time well spent. The cost of failure is too high, especially when simple reminders can make a big difference. Review your A to C game analysis, injecting logic statements, strategic reminder, hand histories, or anything else you need to prepare for preventing your game from crashing. Performance. Stay focused on playing well until you recognize that your game has begun to slip or you see a sign of one of your mental game problems. When that happens, quickly make the appropriate tactical and mental corrections. Addressing these problems as soon as they arise and not waiting for them to accumulate will make it easier for you to remain in control. Also, keep in mind that even if you've been successful at preventing tactical and mental mistakes early in a session, it doesn't mean you should become complacent. As the session wears on, fatigue and accumulation can make it harder, not easier, to continue to be in control. Remember to quit the session if, for any reason, you're no longer able to correct your C-game mistakes. The goal is to improve upon them, not reinforce bad play. Cool down. After your session, review your progress in correcting your C-game mistakes. Remember, the transfer of skill concept makes it necessary to consider the difficulty of the session. Review or repeat your mental hand history on days that are particularly difficult. This helps to reduce accumulated emotion and makes learning the correction easier. Yes, this is repetitive, but would you rather repeat a mental hand history or continue to make the same mistakes at the table? Analysis. Away from the table, you can gain valuable repetitions in improving your C game by posting hand histories, editing and reviewing mental hand histories, watching videos, speaking with a coach, and doing anything else that directly addresses it. This feeds into your warm-up and completes the cycle of improvement. Your progress might be steady, or it could be full of steps forward and backwards. Either way, stay focused on improving your current C game until you have enough proof that it's gone and has been replaced by your previous B game. This is the concept of inchworm in action. The simple way of knowing that your game has moved forward is that your previous C game doesn't show up even in the most difficult level 5 contexts and without any effort. Invariably, players make a lot of progress over a few weeks or months and then become lazy. They assume these improvements have reached the level of unconscious competence, but don't realize the importance of the transfer of skill concept. Keep them on your radar until you have proof. It doesn't take a lot of time and will prevent major steps backwards. Solve your learning errors. Since learning is a skill with a range, you have a learning A game and a learning C game. The approach to solving your learning errors is the same approach you use to solve your performance errors. Eliminate the C game mistakes. Unfortunately, they are not always obvious. Below are 5 common learning errors and their corrections with the stage of either the ALM or the ZLM in which they occur. Plateau. Intangible competence and unconscious incompetence. The biggest strides in your learning often come during periods of great inspiration. So, what do you do when your previous steep learning curve has flatlined? Maybe this has happened because you don't know what to work on next, or because you have achieved a long-term poker goal, such as winning a large tournament. Poker could be feeling like a grind, and you wish you were as excited about the game as when you first started playing. Whatever the reason, you need a way to make poker exciting again. If you choose not to address the problem, your game is at risk of becoming outdated. If that happens, you'll face a huge investment in time in order to catch up. Instead, try challenging yourself with new goals, learning a new game, or getting a coach. You don't have to dramatically increase your learning curve right from the start. You just need to get it climbing upwards again. Premature realization of skill. Conscious incompetence. In the race to master skills, poker players often think they've reached the finish line when they're actually just stepping up to the starting line. This often happens while working away from the table, when they feel as though they really get something. Their sense of understanding feels so strong that they assume the concept can be easily applied at the table. Then, when they actually get to the table, they make mistakes that reveal how much improvement is still required for mastery. They hadn't accounted for how much repetition is needed to master a skill. It is not instant, as much as players wish it were. The simple solution to this issue is to realize that the first time you've recognized a new mistake or a new tactic, you've entered the first conscious stage of learning. You still need to work through the next 2 stages of the process before the correction of that mistake is truly learned. Immediately knowing the mistake. Conscious competence. Ever make a play and realize immediately afterwards that it was a mistake? Part of the problem was failing to know the right decision in the moment, but many players fail to dig any deeper than this. They assume that because they recognize the mistake immediately, the problem is solved, and no further work is necessary to prevent the mistake from happening again. However, this is the perfect time to focus on it. Why? You're so close to mastering it. Putting in the extra work can help that skill reach the level of unconscious competence so that the next time you will know the correct decision before you act, not after. Intentionally learning while playing. Conscious competence. During a session is not the time to be actively learning. It is the time to be taking the test and prove what you have already learned. Many players use up valuable mental energy, reviewing previous hands, doing equity calculations, and fixating on past mistakes while playing. The problem is that they're actively trying to learn and play at the same time. Neither process will get the amount of mental energy it needs to be done well. Still, some players believe this is an effective way to learn, which in fact makes them more likely to repeat the same mistakes they're trying to learn from. They don't realize this method of learning is flawed and fail to put in the required work off the tables. If you become accustomed to learning in this way, breaking out of it can be tough. Aim to make only slight adjustments while playing, and do your active learning away from the table. If it's helpful, jot down the things you want to revisit after a session, so you don't have to try and remember them all. This will allow you to remain focused on the action, while still making sure that the issues that come up will be addressed later on. Overconsumption. lack of unconscious competence. There is a lot of poker material available, and it's easy to consume so much of it that you can't make practical use of it all. This could even happen to you if you try to apply all of the material in this book to your game all at once. If you're constantly learning new things and not spending enough time mastering what you have already learned, you will have too much to think about and not enough space in your mind to consider it all. New information is exciting and can make you feel hopeful about its potential to better your game. In actuality, new information often proves to be a false prophet. It may improve your game, but not as substantially as you had hoped. When you haven't yet mastered the knowledge you currently have, a new piece of information becomes just another thing you have to consciously think about. This puts you at risk to outlevel yourself, become lost in your own thoughts, and suffer a big step backwards during a downswing. Make sure you are mastering existing knowledge and eliminating C-game mistakes before trying to add new concepts to your game. Client story. Matt's Keating, mid-stakes, limit hold'em. My biggest learning problem was accepting the reality of my level. I didn't know it at the time, but I was learning a lot of new things only to the level of conscious competence. Then, the bottom would fall out, and I would fall back to my C game without even realizing what happened. This cycle was slowing down my learning process. I was spending too much time focused on parts of my game that I already knew really well, rather than training the things I didn't know well. I realized the reason I was cutting my learning short was related to being a perfectionist. I would become overly emotional and fearful of failure when I didn't know something. That compelled me to overthink situations and end up playing it safe and predictable way, not using any moves that weren't mastered. Now, I'm working in a much more process-oriented way. I can see the overall plan for learning, and this takes away all the stress. I have much more trust in my decisions, even when I'm not certain they're right, because I have a process for finding and fixing any mistakes. That allows me to learn a lot faster, and keeps me focused on improving the consciously competent parts of my game until they become mastered. I found that keeping a written journal really helps a lot. Now I make video journals because they're just as effective and take less time. The journal keeps me constantly aware of my weaknesses and my A game, so I always know what I'm working on, especially in the weak parts of my game. I use the mental hand history to think deeply about the cause of my mistakes and to search for good strategies for eliminating them from my game. I like how it digs deep below the surface to uncover the real reasons why problems show up. When I can understand the problem at a deep level, I automatically feel at ease and never need to overthink it. I'm not perfect. Sometimes I still get a little lazy when it comes to working on my mental game. Recently, I was a little annoyed by a poor run and started to miss a lot of bets, which is a huge mistake in limit hold'em. In the past, this setback would have led to mistake tilt, but instead of getting annoyed and making bigger mistakes, I was able to analyze the situation and see the real problem. I was tired. I had started a demanding new schedule and wasn't giving myself enough breaks. Awareness is the most important thing for me. When I know the enemy better, he's easier to defeat. Make continual progress. Athletes across the sports world are constantly trying to improve. This goal is built into the fabric of their careers. They understand how intensely their competition is working and realize that if they aren't moving forward, they're bound to fall behind. Whether you're playing great or horribly, there's always an opportunity to improve. The key is to always be tuned into your capability, which is why maintaining your A to C game analysis is so important. If you are having an off day, acknowledge it and realize that it's a great opportunity to improve. If you're tired, tilted, or just not feeling it for some reason, prepare to play a solid B game and don't even worry about playing your A game. Improvement on a day like that means making sure your C game leaks don't show up, or you at least hold them off for longer than you were able to previously. Too often, poker players don't even play or won't even take the opportunity to work on their games when they're not feeling 100%. However, as the transfer of skill concept illustrates, one of the best times to improve your C game is on a day when it's most likely to show up. Plus, since preventing C game mistakes is a significant challenge, you gain high-value repetitions each time you're successful. Go into the session prepared to battle your weaknesses and celebrate even the slightest improvements. This will not only improve your tactical game, but will also increase your confidence and mental endurance. On the other hand, when you're feeling strong, fresh, and ready to play at a high level, it's important to continue to push yourself and not get complacent. Your definition of improvement should be progress relative to your capability on a given day. You can't know the limits of your capability until the day is over. So push yourself to play better, no matter where you are within your range. At the heart of continual improvement is your A to C game analysis. When things start to go badly at the poker table, it can feel as though your game is in a free fall. Knowing exactly what level your game has fallen to gives you something tangible to grab hold of. Rather than reminding yourself just to focus and play well, you have knowledge of exactly what needs your focus. If you rotate a bell curve 90 degrees counterclockwise, you see a bell curve ladder. The better you are able to define each rung in this ladder, the easier it is to stop your game from falling and to climb back up once your game has stabilized. When evaluating progress, it's critical that you compare apples to apples. As the transfer of skill concept illustrates, comparing an incredibly difficult day to an easy one not only causes frustration, it also leads to inaccurate conclusions and misconceptions. Making an appropriate comparison allows you to see progress where you probably rarely see it, at the back end of your range. On a day where you played poorly, realizing you were less terrible than a previous session can be strangely satisfying. It validates the hard work you've been putting into improving your game, which is pretty rare, an amazing thing to see on a bad day. On the flip side, after a profitable session, you may realize that you could have played a lot better. So rather than becoming complacent the next time you play well, you are instead motivated to challenge your best and raise the bar even higher. The following suggestions will further help you get into the habit of improving your game. Make small stuff big. Aggressively learn from failure. Practice. Take a vacation. Make small stuff big. When looking to improve, players only focus on the major leaks in their game, when often it's the small stuff that has the biggest impact. At every level of poker, the edges can be very small, so any improvement matters. While each improvement may seem minute, when done consistently, day after day, they have an exponential effect, similar to compound interest on a mortgage. Another mistake players often make is giving too much attention to their biggest winning and losing hands. These are hands that have the greatest impact on how much they win or lose, so it seems logical to focus on them. However, not only do these hands usually involve standard decisions, they rarely contain anything to learn from. Here are a few examples of the types of hands that players often look when attempting to learn from their sessions. Hands where your decisions didn't come easily. Rather than reviewing a hand based on whether you won or lost it, instead focus on the hands that were the most challenging. In general, the more thought a decision requires, the more there is to learn from it. Small pots that you won or lost. Ask yourself if you could have made or saved an extra blind here or there. Unique hands you played. Ask yourself how you would have played in your opponent's position, or if you were dealt a different hand. Smaller spots where you didn't know how to proceed immediately. It can be easy to presume you have nothing else to work on, but that's never the case. There will always be small details of your game for you to analyze. If you don't address small issues while they're still small and relatively easy to fix, they will eventually become bigger and more complex issues down the line. A tiny leak may not hurt your win rate much at 2-4, but it could prove to be a major problem at 5-10. Why wait for the mistake to become more costly before beginning to work on it? Aggressively learn from failure. Read stories about successful people in any field, and you'll see an important commonality in how they view failure. They see it not as something permanent or to be avoided, but as a part of the process of learning and succeeding. There are innumerable famous and inspiring quotes about failure. Here are a few. Would you like me to give you the formula for success? It's quite simple, really. Double your rate of failure. You're thinking of failure as the enemy of success, but it isn't at all. You can be discouraged by failure, or you can learn from it. So go ahead and make mistakes. Make all you can. Because remember, that's where you'll find success. Thomas Watson, founder of IBM. Failure is simply the opportunity to begin again, this time more intelligently. Henry Ford, founder of Ford Motor Company. I have not failed 10,000 times. I have successfully found 10,000 ways that will not work. Thomas Edison, inventor of the light bulb. It's natural to get a little down when you make a mistake or experience failure. What's most important is how you recover from it. Does the disappointment fuel you to work harder and make the most out of the mistake? Or do you get stuck and allow these negative feelings to linger? Failure provides a great opportunity to learn because it highlights the limitations in your capabilities. Only when you can learn from those limitations will you be able to truly push your game higher. Practice. In all sports, there are clear ways for athletes to increase their level of skill without having to compete. Golfers hit balls on the driving range and play practice rounds. Runners utilize a track and a weight room, and boxers have heavy bags and sparring partners they can hit. Poker, on the other hand, doesn't have a clearly defined trading environment without monetary consequences. Some would argue that play money games provide a good training ground. However, beyond teaching the basic rules of the game, the style of play is too unlike real poker to be valuable. The benefit of practice is that you get to test new skills in an environment where there's less pressure. Plus, you can rack up valuable repetitions that make it easier to transfer a skill to tougher situations. Here are a few suggestions for ways to practice. Play lower stakes. Drop down several limits to play a session where, for example, you focus entirely on preflop play, turn aggression, or C-game mistakes. Then see how much that practice pays off in your normal games. Play more tables at lower stakes. Playing more tables online than normal is a great way to work solely on your tactical C-game mistakes. The high frequency of hands makes it a lot harder for you to think, and that forces you to work on a part of your game that typically feels easy. Play fewer tables. If you are trying to expand your A-game, playing fewer tables is a good way to put more focus on each table and decision. It allows you to think more deeply over each hand and explore any new insight you're able to gain. It also is a great way to improve focus, since the slower pace makes it easier to become distracted. Hand replayers. Replaying old hands from your Hold'em Manager or Poker Tracker database is the rough equivalent of a basketball player reviewing game tape. This is the most common way that poker players practice, and it is genuinely risk-free. Load up a bunch of random hands or ones fitted for specific situations. Then pause the hand on every street and make a decision as though you were actually playing it for the first time. You can also play the hand from the villain's perspective. Simulators like SNG Wiz and Hold'em Resources Manager are good examples of dynamic hand replayer options. Change game formats. Some skills can be developed just by changing the type of game you play. Tournament players can replicate final table situations by playing heads-up cash games and sit-and-goes. They can also play deep-stack cash games to work on the early stages and short-stack cash games to practice for the middle stages. Also, heads-up games are generally a great way to improve mental game issues, as they tend to be mentally tougher. Use these suggestions or come up with your own ways of integrating practice into your learning process. It's a low-cost option that can pay huge dividends in the long run. Learn by teaching. There are many reasons that players decide to become coaches: to make money, to give back to the community, and to gain exposure. Many coaches also do it because they know it'll make them better players. Writing articles, recording training videos, and working with students reinforces concepts they already know and allows them to be understood at even higher levels. Each time a coach shares what they know, they get additional repetitions, and their knowledge becomes more deeply ingrained. Coaching helps knowledge move through the learning process, and that includes helping intangible competence become conceptual competence. Sometimes in the process of sharing their expertise, they often communicate something they didn't even realize they knew. This spontaneous understanding is exactly the same as making a creative new move while playing. When in the zone, a coach has access to more knowledge, and that allows them to bring their own intangible competence to the surface. And you don't even have to be an official coach to reap the benefits of coaching. For example, if you're in a study group and you're the best player, don't be discouraged that you don't have anyone to learn from. Take advantage of the opportunity to solidify what you know by communicating it to the other members of the group. Encourage them to ask questions, so you're forced to explain things in various ways. This helps you to conceptualize poker decisions and frees you up to acquire new intangible competence. Take a vacation. Poker players are often quite reluctant to take time off. Even though the value of rest is well known, they still don't like the amount of time it can take to knock off the rust and get back to playing at their pre-vacation levels. Consequently, they don't take enough time off during the year, and their ability to learn suffers as a result. The solution all comes down to organization and planning. Keeping your A to C game analysis up to date makes this easier. Before you leave, take notes about your game as though you're writing them to your post-vacation self. This not only allows you to put poker down so you can truly enjoy some time away, it also helps you to refresh your memory when you return. When you get back, you have two options. One, jump right into playing without reviewing your notes. Two, review your notes and play fewer tables or lower stakes so you can steadily work your way back up to a high level. The value of jumping right back into your normal routine without any preparation is that it gives you a great opportunity to test whether being away has improved your game. You could find, for example, that areas of your game that previously took a lot of mental effort feel easier after your break. It's as though the time away allowed them to sink deeper into your mind. You can then use your vacation notes as a measuring stick to compare your pre- and post-vacation. The other option, using the notes, practice, and a solid warm-up to steadily climb your way back up to the top of your game, is less risky. Since players who prefer this route often want to accelerate their climb, consider making it a goal to get to the top of your game in less time after each trip. For example, if it currently takes you 1 week to get back on top, try to reduce that to 4 or 5 days after the next trip. Chapter 4. Decision Making. Long-term success in poker comes down to the quality of your execution at the table. The money you make, the number of tournament titles you own, and the respect you get as a player are mainly a result of your ability to make correct decisions. Grasping exactly how to make correct decisions is such a critical part of success, yet many players don't spend enough time working on it. They assume that their constant focus on gaining greater tactical knowledge automatically upgrades their decision-making abilities as well. Unfortunately, this is not the case. There is a critical difference between having tactical knowledge and being able to extract that knowledge in order to make correct decisions. For example, when facing a bet, your decision-making could be broken down like this. 1. What is my opponent's range? 2. What odds is the pot laying me? 3. What is my equity versus my opponent's range? 4. What are the odds that my hand will improve? 5. Will my opponent pay me off if I hit my hand? In the process of making a decision, you evaluate the answers to these questions. This is different from the actual answers themselves, which are derived from, for example, your tactical knowledge of pot odds, equity, and your opponent's skill. Ideally, you want your decision-making ability to be on the same level as your tactical knowledge. When they are out of sync, the following two problems can occur. 1. Players out-level themselves when they attempt to consider factors in a hand without the knowledge to back it up. This happens when a brand new player tries to spot a physical tell on their opponent. Having watched TV, they think this is what they're supposed to be doing. Their mistake is that they're attempting to apply knowledge that they don't have yet. It's like trying to pump water out of a dry well. While this problem is often thought to be the exclusive domain of weaker players, it also happens to highly skilled players when they don't adapt to a drop in their mental functioning when tired, tilted, or distracted. 2. Players make poor decisions when their decision-making process fails to utilize their existing knowledge. The well isn't dry, they just can't drink from it. A poker player making the right decision is essentially the same as a golfer, quarterback, or downhill skier selecting the right shot, pass, or angle. Athletes spend countless hours not only honing their techniques, but also their decision-making abilities. They know that all their hard work can be wasted if they're not able to make the right decision when it matters most. Within the decision-making process, there are three types of knowledge accessed by your mind. Intuition, intangible competence, reacting in the moment. Thinking, conscious knowledge that requires effort to extract. Instinct, knowledge trained to the level of unconscious competence. Players often make the mistake of assuming that intuition and instinct mean the same thing, but that couldn't be farther from the truth. Intuition utilizes your entire range of knowledge, whereas your instinct is only based on the knowledge that exists at the level of unconscious competence. Between them is a conscious decision-making tool that you don't always use as effectively as you like. Thinking. Intuition. Intuition is a strong feeling, sense, or thought about the right decision in a hand that is based on new and existing knowledge, particularly intangible competence, new knowledge that you can't explain yet. Intuition happens spontaneously when in the zone or playing at a high level. When you're faced with a decision, both new and existing knowledge react to the unique details of the situation and result in an intuitive decision. This is the mental equivalent of a goalie making a split-second adjustment to block a shot, a defensive back in football sniffing out a receiver's route to make an interception, or a tennis player picking a lethal moment to hit a drop shot. Poker players who tend to rely mainly on their intuition are often called feel players and refer to their intuition as their gut. These players still think through hands, but when choosing the right play, they rely more on feeling than constructing an argument in their head. And while this may come naturally to them, it doesn't mean that their gut is always right. The farther you fall from the zone, the more your feelings are influenced by flaws in your tactical and mental game. At these lower levels of performance, You're no longer able to make smart, intuitive decisions, and relying on a feeling becomes risky. You might feel as though your opponent has a very strong hand, but you're really only looking for a justification for folding because of your